compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. This is hour two of the program, and I do thank you for listening. The number to dial to be on the air is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Cyrus, what do you think about this story? I'm reacting negatively to it. And I'm not, I mean, I can tell you why, but maybe I'm just not seeing some aspect of it. So this mom has cancer. Her name is Molly. Beth, the daughter. No, I'm sorry, I got it backwards. Beth is the mom. Molly is the daughter. And the mom wants to find a man, a husband, for her daughter. This is an article in the New York Post. So last week, the mom, Beth, did just that. She purchased, rented, I guess, a 47-foot by 20-foot ad, like a big billboard, in Times Square saying, "Date my daughter." And it shows a photo of her 30-year-old daughter, Molly, and it gives a URL for her dating profile. Now, she says, the mom, "I just want to know that I'm leaving her in good hands." She's 61 years old. She's from Boston. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2004. She was treated with chemotherapy in June of 2020. Doctors informed her that she had developed metastatic breast cancer that had spread extensively to her bones. So she says time is of the essence because she and her husband, Rick, a 62-year-old medical writer, want to be able to walk Molly down the aisle together. Beth says, "I would like to see my daughter well settled." So even though, I mean, things look really grim for her, and it may be the case that she won't survive very long, this is what she's doing. She's saying, "I want to find a good man for my daughter to love." She says, "I want her to be happily married. And because of her health situation, there's urgency to do this." So, I don't know. I mean, give me a second opinion, Cyrus, on this one, because it strikes me as, I mean, even over and above sort of the gimmickiness of it, it just seems gimmicky to me. But, I mean, who knows who's going to answer that ad? And I mean, come on, an attractive 30-year-old woman whose picture, 47 feet across, her picture's on Times Square. It just strikes me as though there are probably a lot of unsavory men who might try to exploit this situation, and maybe the daughter will wind up in danger or worse. This just seems like the wrong way to go about this. I understand the mom's feelings, I get it, but it just rubs me the wrong way. And maybe I'm wrong about this. What do you think?
I don't know. I've been out of the dating game for over 20 years, and this does not seem to be the right way to go about it.
Let's say your daughter was 21. Okay, whatever. And you're on your way out. You have a serious illness. You're on your way out. Would you put your daughter's picture in Times Square and say, "Date my daughter. Here's the URL"?
Never.
Never?
Never.
I wouldn't do that.
So no, and that's a pretty penny to do something like that. That money could have gone towards education or helping out with a mortgage.
Or decades of membership on a Catholic dating site.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
You're like maxed out till you're 60.
Lifetime membership.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know. It's just a little cultural blip, but it struck me the wrong way.
Yeah, I mean, I sure hope it ends up okay, but that seems rather dangerous.
Yeah, and also, yeah, you're right, dangerous and certain, but also, if you ask me, there are better ways to find a good spouse. Times Square does not come to my mind in the top 1,000 options of places to look for a good spouse for a son or daughter.
Yeah, so, it's nowhere on the option list.
I'm glad it's not just me, because I felt like a stick in the mud when I saw that story, and I thought, I wouldn't do that. But
I mean, it's cute, and I think they're probably having a nice laugh, I hope. I mean, I don't know how serious. I just don't know. I don't know what to make of this.
The New York Times picked it up. Oh, speaking of laughter, I don't know if you're going to love this. This, to me, is so typical. Patton Oswalt, he's a comedian and an actor. I have no clue what he's done. I only see him pop up from time to time obnoxiously on Twitter. So that's my only sense of who he is. But he doesn't strike me as like an A-list celebrity. But he's in the news, and the Daily Wire's got a story about this. At first, what happened was he made this big deal on Twitter. I'll read you the tweet that he sent off a while ago. I finished my set at the whatever club and got a text from Dave Chappelle. He wrote, come over to the arena that he's performing at next door and be my guest and do a guest set. Why not? So he says, so in other words, he struck me as kind of really puffed up. Look at me. Dave Chappelle invited me over to go visit with him. And he finishes by saying, anyway, I ended the year with a real friend and a deep laugh. Can't ask for much more. All right. Well, the other shoe dropped in the ensuing days. Now, the same guy, Patton Oswalt, whatever he's famous for, I do not know, he has issued an apology because he says he realizes now, he says, I'm truly sorry that I didn't consider the hurt that this would cause or the depth of that hurt. Ugh. So easy to think someone else needs growth and miss the need in yourself. Gonna keep trying. And the reason he had to make this apology, Cyrus, is because the trans people came after him.
Yep.
Because they, I'm trying to remember how I put this last time around. I want to be consistent. But when we talked about the Dave Chappelle comedy special that I had no intention of seeing, because I'm not interested in profanity and that kind of stuff. And I know that, you know, I know he's funny, but it's too much for me. But we talked about it, and you and I talked about it, and I said, okay, I'm going to watch it. It's my homework assignment. So I did watch it. And he spoke truth to the trans people. And he even said along the way, you know, I support you. But he talked about some of their thin skinness and the double standards and the hypocrisy. And he nailed it as far as I was concerned. I thought he did a good job, and I thought he was fair about it. And they just absolutely will not put up with that. It's something up with which they will not put. They will not tolerate any criticism of any kind from anybody, anywhere. And so they're still beating these drums. They're still trying to get Dave Chappelle, I guess, canceled. It just seems to make him bigger and more popular. So this goofy guy, Patton Oswalt, B or C list guy, I guess, he was wrapping himself in the mantle of being Dave Chappelle's friend. But you notice, you know, he talks about he was a good friend, can't ask for much more, or a real friend, excuse me, says, can't ask for much more. Well, boy, that friendship came to a grinding halt as soon as the trans people started coming after him and denouncing him. Because you know what will happen, Cyrus? You know that if you don't have the stature of a J.K. Rowling and all of her billions that insulate her from the mob,
yep.
And by mob, I'm talking about the Twitter mob.
Or you're not cancel-proof like Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, you can't cancel him. So some relative pipsqueak in the B or C list of celebritydom, that kind of person doesn't have that kind of insulation. And so what happened? He cut and ran. And, you know, gee, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize the depth. It's all in caps. The depth of the hurt that my tweet would cause. His tweet said, I went, hung out with a friend, good times. And yet, that was just, it was beyond bearable for the trans people who came after him. I think you're about to say something.
I don't know. I like Patton Oswalt. I know who he is. He's been, I like stand-up comedy, so I've been listening to him for years. And I wouldn't recommend him. But personally, I've enjoyed his comedy, and he's in a lot of shows he voice acts in a bunch of stuff. So I know who he is, and I've been
but you also like Pink Floyd, so
I've been watching Oswald's career, you know, blow up, and he's bigger than he's ever been. But in the last
What is he big for?
Well,
what has he done?
He's just in everything. His voice is everywhere.
All right.
But the last year or two, he's been just very extreme left. And with COVID, he ended up doing a bunch of stand-up shows, and you had to show proof of vaccination. He was one of the first comedians to be like, I'm not doing comedy for anyone that's not vaccinated. And everybody has to wear a mask everywhere he goes. And so he canceled places in the South that were like, well, we're not going to force people to get vaccinations to come to our venue.
He was just trying to virtue signal.
That's exactly
trying to show,
where I was going. Big time virtue signaling here. And that's the same thing with his, these comedians all stick together. They hang out and they might be, you know, complaining about different things and have different viewpoints, but at the end of the day, they're all comedians and they hang out together. So I believe him when he's like, yeah, this is my friend. But then, like, would you get rid of a picture of me because I said something stupid on the air? No, you would already have gotten rid of it.
Oh, so you set yourself up and then you slammed the door before I did could before slam it on you.
Right? That's right. I sure did. I saw where that was going. I saw you
were halfway through your point and you realized, uh-oh.
I saw you running for the door to slam it on me. So I had to shut it first.
Well done.
Thank you, sir.
Well, okay, so am I off base on this or what? Because I think this is cowardice on his part.
I'm disappointed when I see celebrities that I enjoy make decisions like this. This is no Gary Sinise.
I'll say. Well, you've just educated me. I know now 99% more about this guy than I did 10 minutes
than
ago.
You wanted to know.
Than I wanted to know. I still think it's foolish, so... And, yeah. You know, maybe the essence or the moral to the story is if you are standing up for something that is right and true and good, you know, presuming that you're standing up for it in a good and honorable way, then stick to your guns. And if all the howling, you know, foaming at the mouth, as Father Z says, spittle-flecked, nutty people, come after you because they don't like the fact that you're friends with so-and-so or they don't like the fact that you stood up and said something, ignore them. Ignore them. Now, maybe you can't do it quite so easily if they rule your financial world because they won't buy tickets or they'll boycott you or something. I understand, you know, what those pressures might be, but I think there are far more people in this world who would admire somebody who stuck to his guns and said, no, if this guy's my friend, I said it publicly and I'll stand by that.
Personally. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Because you don't want that on your karmic record.
No, you really don't.
You really don't. You really, really don't. Amy in Atlanta, Georgia, thank you for your patience and welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Comment on Mark from Atlanta regarding irreverence. For the Eucharist and the Tabernacle.
Uh-huh.
Plenty of churches that I've attended fall into that category. And I get to church early to say a lot of, you know, just to pray before Mass. And I either waffle between anger or just sadness, true sadness, to watch deacons, lectors, ushers, you know, just kind of traipse across and stop and chat with people in a loud voice. I almost want to cry, seriously. Mm-hmm. But I want to point you to an article called Kneeling at the Gates of Paradise by Anthony Esselin. Do you know his writings?
I do, yes. He used to teach at Providence College, and I believe he was ousted from there not that long ago.
Yes. Yes,
he's a good man, and he's a believer.
Because he stood up. Because he stood up for what he believes, and he wouldn't kowtow to the university. Anyway, I encourage you and your readers to read that article. And I also wanted to comment, there is a church here in Atlanta that is being, the interior is being renovated. They are putting in a high altar, a low altar, and an altar rail.
Gloria in excelsis Deo.
I'm telling you what. And there are people flocking to this church. They have also been given the approval to say the Mass in Latin one day a week, I believe, and people are flocking to it.
I'm not surprised. That's good. What a precious jewel that you have in your own backyard. So I'm sure you're already doing what you can to support that kind of thing, but it makes me happy to hear that, Amy. And thanks for the recommendation. I appreciate that. God bless you. Let's go now to Mark in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for the call. Anyways,
you're welcome. Thank you for the call.
Been listening
you
to
called
the program
me.
Or, oh, yes. Well, thank you for taking the call is what I meant.
Okay.
But anyways, you know, I've been a new listener to the program just because I didn't know about it. Somebody turned me on to your program. Very excited.
Great.
And
great.
I've been hearing some fantastic things about the rosary. And I've got a very interesting thing to say about it. And then I've got a concern.
All right.
First thing is I'm taking care of my mother with Alzheimer's now for 6 years, and I bring her to Mass. Always did. Been going to Mass my whole life with her. Mm-hmm. And I've been bringing her to Mass, and, you know, she can get distracted. She can get this or that. But because of all the talk on the rosary, I thought, you know, what a great idea. Why don't I bring the rosary that she used to hold on to that we have and see mm-hmm. what happens? And I brought it with last Saturday. We go to a Saturday night service, and I brought it with and gave it to her and wrapped it around her hand. And, you know, Pat, it was a win-win because I think it really triggered something. She never let go of that rosary except for once when she tried to hand it to me. And I just, you know, very, very mm-hmm. Delicately just, no, that's yours. And wrapped it around her hand, and she never let go of that rosary. And I think, you know, even after 6 years, that triggered something. She always held a rosary when we went to Mass years ago, and then, I don't know, sadly got away from bringing the rosary. But what a fantastic thing. It was a win-win because obviously it triggered something for her, and I got to see her aging hands holding that rosary again. And, you know, I'm always going to have that with me. I'm always going to have that image. If she was called home tomorrow, mm-hmm. I'm going to have that image of her aging hands holding that rosary, and that's great. I'll have that for the rest of my life. It's just it was a great thing. That was the first thing.
And so what is your concern? Sounds like that's all good. What's the concern?
Well, yeah, that was great. The concern is, you know, I've been Catholic my whole life, always gone to church. I went to a Catholic grade school, first through sixth grade, and then was pulled out and put into a public school. And then after that, I had CCD classes for, you know, the 2-3 years after that. Nowhere in there did they ever teach saying the rosary.
How old are you?
Our Father, we learned confession. I'm 50.
Okay. That would explain exactly why you did not get that. Because you went through CCD, which is typically what we've called it in the U.S., after the council and during a time, especially in the 1980s. It was pretty bad in the 1970s too. But by the time you got into grammar school and you were getting CCD, if that's where you got your religious instruction, it had become largely content-free. And there was an aversion, actually, in many circles at Catholic parishes, not everywhere, but in many circles, there was a real, you know, they were allergic to pious devotions. And so any kind of emphasis on the rosary or wearing the scapular or adoration, those things just basically disappeared. So you went through catechesis at a time when it was in many respects a wasteland, and it was very content free. And I'm sorry that that's the case. I went through a bit of that, but I was saved because of Catholic school. For the most part, I went to Catholic school. And so, thankfully, the religious sisters that taught in the school that I attended were very good about promoting these kinds of things. So I was lucky in that regard. But I'd say most people who are your age, a little bit older, a little bit younger, went through what you're describing, unfortunately.
Interesting. Okay, I didn't know that. You know, we had everything. We had, we knelt down for at the railing for the Eucharist. You know, we had confession.
That's good.
And we had all that, you know, first through sixth grade, we had that, you know, a Mass 3 times a week and then once on the weekend. So, Mass 4 times a week. You know, a lot of the nuns and the priests were teaching this, you know, the classes and everything. And here I am, 50 years old, and it's like, wow, I don't even know how to say the rosary. So I'm getting excited about learning how to do that. I'm looking forward to saying the rosary with my mom on a daily basis.
That's good. I wish I had more time, Mark, but thank you for that. And yeah, I want to encourage you. And you know what we can do to help you with that is get the Relevant Radio app on your phone. It's free. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little icon of a Bible and a cross where it says pray. Just click on devotions, and it will take you right to the Holy Rosary. It'll teach you how to pray it, give you all the mysteries and everything. I think you'll like it. Thank you. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Compelling insights.
Yes, we've been waiting for a long, long time.
Unpredictable conversations.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Encouragement for your day.
We ain't gonna wait no more. We're getting ready to rock and roll.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Not only back in town, back on the air. Happy New Year. 888-914-9149. And Cyrus is back. We haven't heard your voice in, I don't know, 2 weeks? 10 days, something like that?
That's right. Yep, you're welcome, everybody.
Well, you're back, and that's what matters. Thank you. A couple things I want to make people aware of is Yahoo News is referring to as an invisible addiction that is, in some sense, sort of fueled by the pandemic, and that is the addiction to gambling. Interesting. I mean, it's not a topic that I talk about very often. I think I told you my one and only story about gambling, didn't I, Cyrus, about the lottery ticket? I told you that story, didn't I?
I'm sure you have, but it's already lost.
I bet.
So yeah, let's hear it again.
Well, briefly. So anyway, the background is this Yahoo story. It's all about how many people have been sucked into a gambling addiction. So, you know, video poker and stuff online, and they're losing money. In fact, they're, in some cases, in the case of families, losing the family budget money, losing the money to pay the mortgage and to buy the food, and the kids and the wife are suffering. So it's a real problem, and it gives statistics about how many more people now are seeking addiction recovery as a result of the gambling. And a lot of people, they get into it and they can't stop. It talks about how you get a dopamine high when you win a little something. So it's not even so much the money, it's the winning, I guess, psychologically. It talks about one guy who was $250,000 in debt because of his gambling habit. Finally, it sounds like there was a bit of an intervention with his friends, and they got him to do a 12-step program, and he's getting out of the problem. He's no longer gambling. So I encourage you, especially, I mean, it may not be you listening right now who has a gambling problem. You might know somebody who does, and it might be a secret gambling problem. So you could share this with your Facebook friends or on other social media platforms, and who knows who might need to read this article and maybe get some help, because it gives some avenues and resources for people who really do need help from this addiction. So really quickly, Cyrus, my story. This is going back now to the mid-1980s. And back in those days, Nancy and I had been married for, you know, 4 or 5 years, poor as church mice. We've always been a one-income family. And at that time, you know, there was never enough money. We had kids and then more kids and then more kids and more kids. So there was always too much month left at the end of the money. But God always provided, and we always managed. And one day, I was coming home from work, and I stopped in at a, you know, like a gas station mini market, got a cup of coffee for the drive home, and I had like $5 in my pocket, and I thought, what the heck, I'll take 5 scratch-offs. So I get the 5 scratch-offs, I go out in my car, scratch them off, one of them's for $100. And I thought, wow, I mean,
yeah, it's beginner's luck.
Beginner's luck. That was gas money for a week or two, you know. So what did I do? I went right back into the mini market, and I told the guy behind the counter, I said, I'd like 100 more scratch-offs. He's like, fine. I'm sure he's seen that a million times. So get back in my car. Then I show up at home. Honey, I'm home. What have you got there? Well, I've got 100 lottery scratch-off tickets. What? You spent $100? No. I didn't do that. Here's what happened. I spent $5 when I got my gas and my coffee. Spent $5. One of them was for $100. That's how come I have 100 scratch-off lottery tickets. She's like, okay, that's a different story. So we had fun. We sat down. We got out some quarters, and I think my older kids helped us, and we scratched off and scratched off and scratched off. We had a scratch-off party, and one of those, I mean, there were some like for $25, maybe another one for $100 or some, you know, small amount. One of them was for $1,000.
Get out of here.
Yeah?
You've never told me this story.
I thought I did, nope, so forgive
me. I don't know
this. So now, can you picture my glittering eyes as I'm gazing upon this $1,000? I mean, that's $1,000 free of money that I not only didn't have, but I could really, really use.
Please tell me you didn't go buy 1,000 scratch-off tickets.
No, but I will tell you this. I was tempted. to do that. I was tempted to do that. And here's the moral to the story for me. I felt that little twinge inside me awakening that as I look back on it, and even at that moment, I felt this could be the beginning of a gambling addiction. I just felt it like this urge, do it, do it, do it, do it some more, do it some more. And it was really palpable. So I went back to that mini market and I got my $1,000, and I've never, that I remember anyway, I've never bought a scratch-off ticket since then. Or if I have, it was, you know, just on a lark. But I just nipped it in the bud because I could feel that little voice inside me saying, do it, do it, do it,
do
gamble
it.
Some more.
Do
You're
it.
Going to win. And of course, you know, the odds are so against you. So that was the end of it. And I look back actually with satisfaction that I nipped it in the bud, because who knows what that could have become.
That's great that you didn't go back and do more. Like when that little voice is on your shoulder, yeah, and it's the, yeah, you know, the bad angel or yeah, I guess demon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what would have happened? Yeah, I sure did. I mean, and it's not difficult to get addicted to something that's pleasurable. It's just how we are. That's how we are as human beings. So my point is that if I hadn't done that, I could easily kind of in my mind's eye picture what could have happened. I could have, you know, either, you know, bought 1,000 lottery tickets and then, let's say, come up empty-handed, but really, convinced that, you know, the next big win is right around the corner, and maybe I'll get $50,000, or maybe I'll get $100,000, maybe I could pay off my house. All I have to do is just get enough of these tickets or start playing the lottery, and I'm sure, and this is probably what happens to many people, is eventually it takes over, and then when you don't have the money from your winnings to put down to buy the tickets or whatever, you start dipping into the money that you don't have, you know, that you need for groceries and keeping the lights turned on and making your house payment. And that's where some of these people, they get into really dire straits, because they're starting to squander the money that they need to feed their families. And that's when things fall apart and get really bad. So who knows what could have happened, but I'm sure glad that I did it the way I did it.
I was with a friend. We went to a casino, and you know, we had like $20. We had no money. We didn't have $20 to spend. But anyway, you were like, "This is all we have to spend. Once we spend it, we leave." And so I went through my $20 fast, and he got up a little bit, and he was really excited. So I'm rooting him on, and then he lost it all. And then he's like, "All right, I got to just go back. I got to go to the ATM to get out some more money."
Yeah,
I'm like, "No. That's we said.
Yeah,
this
you're
is
done.
When we're done, we're done." And so I had to drag him out of there. But it was the first taste I had of just how once you get bit with a little bit of success at getting something for nothing, you get hungry for more. And it's like, oh, I can make that back. I can make it back. And what a spiral.
Yeah, and my big jackpot is just around the corner. All I have to do is just keep it up for another 15 minutes. I'm going to hit the jackpot. I'm going to be able to win back all of my money and then some. It's just like a mirage, and obviously the Vegas professionals will tell you that it's rigged against you. And I don't know so much about the lottery, but I would guess, you know, that just statistically speaking, because there's so many people out there, your chance of winning on, like, picking numbers, for example, is infinitesimally small. And yet...
Yeah. More likely to get struck by lightning.
Yeah. Anyway, so... I thought maybe I had told that story, but there it is. It's part of the canon now. 888-914-9149. How about Irene in Orlando, Florida? Good morning, Irene.
Hi there, Patrick. I wanted to talk about getting people back into the Catholic Church, and I think you've written a book on this, and that'll be part of your answer, I'm sure. But I'm very excited that my parish, Blessed Trinity in Orlando, is doing something that I think is sanctioned by the SACB, but I've never heard of it before. And it's called Catholics Returning Home. And it's a 6-part thing. It starts this Thursday. And in the first session, it's going to be 6 sessions in over 6 weeks. And the first session, really interesting, the people who decide that they're going to come, non-practicing Catholics, we've got signs up and down the block where, you know, this is going to be held at our church trying to attract people. The first session is basically sharing your sad story of why you're not a Catholic anymore. A lot of times they said, I talked to the priest about it, and he said a lot of it is about irregular marriages, you know, something Sister So-and-so did a long time ago, all of this, but I'm very excited because in all my years as a practicing Catholic, and, you know, I'm 66, so it's a long time, I've never seen a program like this run at my church. So I'm excited mm-hmm. about it. Are you familiar with this kind of thing? Is there a success? But I'm excited because, you know, we're doing it, and we'll see who shows up on the tree in Orlando, because we've tried to advertise it through the bulletin and tell people to invite people, and as I said, put signs up and down the street. But what is your familiarity with this? Oh, and by the way, I announced on Christmas Day, you know, we have, you know, the Christmas and Easter crowd, so that was great. But what is your experience with this kind of thing? Are you familiar with it?
Yeah,
and
I am.
Basically, what advice do you have for us?
Well, I think the best advice I could give is do it, and you're already doing that, which is wonderful. I think parishes, at least in my experience, I travel quite a lot around the country, and you know, if I haven't been to your parish yet, perhaps I will one of these days. But I've seen from my own experience that parishes that invest the time and energy, and sometimes even money when necessary, on these kinds of programs, they can reap big dividends, especially if it's something that has follow through. So I think you said that this particular form has 6 meetings, which is very good, kind of like a parish mission spread out over 6 different weeks. And I've seen a lot of good come from this. So I am, in a modest way, I'm familiar with this particular program, Catholics Coming Home. And there are others that I've had an occasion to see as well. So I would give a thumbs up and say, this is good, and would that more parishes did it. Now, I kind of detected in there your mention of the people who go to only Christmas and Easter Mass. And if I can volunteer an answer to a question that you didn't exactly ask me, Irene, I think this might fit the overall question here. I think one of the most important things that Catholics can do, and here I'm speaking about lay Catholics who are in the pews, is on Easter and on Christmas, don't treat the people who are obviously there only on Easter and Christmas. I mean, they're not that difficult to pick out of the crowd. And first of all, make them feel welcome. Now, I'm not directing this to you, Irene. I'm sure you already do this. But make them feel welcome. Scooch into the middle of the pew. I mean, one of the most off-putting things, you'll see it all the time in Catholic parishes, you get some man or woman or couple, and they're parked right at the end of the pew. And, you know, they don't have a health condition. It's not like they have to get up and go get oxygen or something. They want to sit right there on the end of the pew. And they don't budge. They will not move. They will not move in. They will not move down. And when people come in, they want to sit there rather than do, you know, the polite thing and to scooch down, they make the people climb over them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a little thing, but it demonstrates a kind of, I don't know, callousness or, you know, it's not courteous. It's not welcoming. And that's just one thing. So I would argue that if you want the Christmas and Easter only people to come back to Mass more often, show them that they're welcome. And go out of your way to show them that they're welcome. Smile at people and greet them after Mass or before Mass for that matter. Don't greet them. Don't chit-chat with them, you know, while you're in the pew waiting for Mass to begin. The church should be quiet and you should be praying and not infringing upon other people who are trying to pray. But afterward, yeah, you know, all these little things combined can add up to people who say, wow, that parish is really welcoming. I think I'd like to go back there. And that does happen. And I dare say that the opposite happens, if I had to guess, when the Easter and Christmas only Catholics show up and they're treated, you know, like Easter and Sunday only Catholics. And they're given the message that, you know, we're kind of irked that you're here. We're kind of irked that you're crowding our parish. And that goes a long way in the opposite direction. So you didn't ask me that question, Irene, but I thought I'd pop it in there for good measure. What are your thoughts? Oh, well, maybe we lost Irene. I don't know. Well, this is also a good time to take a break. If we have a phone difficulty, maybe we can sort that out during the break. But I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We are back. And to prove it, let's go to the phones. Patrick in Sheboygan. Is that right? Yeah, Sheboygan, Michigan. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Madrid. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I want to go back to the Eucharistic reverence question.
Okay.
Is there a proper way to take care of the host when it falls on the ground during communion? I know, obviously, you would pick it up, but what about all the small crumbs and stuff? Because no matter how small it is, it's still Jesus. Mm-hmm. Is there a certain procedure that's supposed to be followed, or how is that supposed to work?
Well, there's a custom that I'm familiar with that goes back quite a long time, and the custom that I'm familiar with is that, let's say that the host falls on the floor during the distribution of Holy Communion, usually what will happen is that the priest, or if it's a deacon, would pause and go get a purificator, which is one of the small white altar cloths that's used, and maybe even dip it in the holy water. Usually there's a little jar of holy water near the tabernacle. And then get the host off the floor, either consume it or put it on the paten and bring it into the sacristy. So if there's a reasonable concern that the host may be contaminated with germs, there is a custom where you would immerse the host in a basin of holy water and let it dissolve. And eventually, once it has dissolved, then what remains, which no longer would have the real presence, because once the properties of bread are gone through dissolution, for example, and it's no longer bread in the strict sense of the word, then the real presence of Christ is no longer there. There's a special drain in the sacristy called a sagrarium, where that water could then be poured down the drain. And there's no disrespect to our Lord because his real presence is gone. But usually also when the priest or the deacon retrieves the host and either self-communicates and consumes it or puts it in the sacristy, usually also they will, with this moistened cloth, they will wipe the area of the floor where the host had fallen so that it will pick up any crumbs that might be remaining there. So that's what I have seen over the years. I think it's a wise custom. It doesn't always happen, but I think it's a very good way of handling that kind of a mishap. Yeah, they happen. Sometimes accidents happen and nobody's at fault, but that seems to me to be a good way to go about it.
Makes sense to me. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's see. How about Christina in Albuquerque? Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Patrick, I have a question about baptism.
Okay.
A young lady, she goes to a Protestant church, talking about baptism, and she said that the child at her church, the child has to be immersed all the way in the water, and that's the proper way. And it seems to me that she believes any other way is not okay. And I know how we do it at our parish. It's not the water's over the child's head, and the child is laid back, and the water is poured. And so I didn't know how to respond to her because she was so set that that was the legitimate way, and anything else was not.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
Good.
So here's what you could say. First thing to point out is that indeed it is true that in the New Testament, what we see baptisms that are conducted where it's not told to us specifically whether it was baptism by immersion or whether it was baptized by pouring. And in a moment, I'll offer you a couple of Bible verses that I think shed a bit of light on this. But suffice to say that either immersion, which is the more strictly literal meaning of the word baptize, it carries with it the connotation in Greek of being immersed in water. Whether it's full immersion or it's pouring, either format is valid. Now, another interesting detail, and that is, I did a study on this some years ago, and I wanted to find out what are the earliest depictions in Christian antiquity of Jesus being baptized. And to my knowledge, at least, all of the artistic depictions of Jesus being baptized do not show him being immersed in water. They show him standing in water, and St. John the Baptist pouring the water over his head from a seashell. Now, is that actually what happened? Because the Bible doesn't tell us. It doesn't. It just says Jesus went down into the water. Did he get completely immersed in the water, or did he get down into the water so it was up to his waist? Did St. John the Baptist dunk him, so to speak, or did he pour water from his shell? And although the Christian iconography and even depictions of the baptism of Jesus in the catacombs, for example, in Rome and other very ancient renditions of this biblical scene, the earliest I could find only show Jesus being baptized with water being poured on him. Now, that doesn't prove anything, but I think it does add an interesting dimension to the discussion, because you would think that, especially in the first few centuries, when they would have clearly had some knowledge or memory of this handed down to them that's been lost since that time, you would think that if he had been immersed in water, that the artistic depictions would show that. And they don't. So that's something to consider. Now, some Bible verses. The first thing is to note that in Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, when St. Peter preached this powerful sermon in Jerusalem, and we're told that the people who listened to him were cut to the heart and said, "What do we do now?" And he said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you." And then we're told at the end of this, this soliloquy of St. Peter, we're told that upwards of 3,000 persons were baptized that very day. Now, I've been to Jerusalem before, and you don't even have to go to Jerusalem to know that it's in a very arid part of the world. And although there were a few pools that were there, the Pool of Bethsaida, for example, and the Pool of Siloam is another example, these pools were not very large. These pools of water were smaller than the typical backyard built-in swimming pool. And so although you could get some people in there who were ill or were seeking a cure, as many did, to baptize 3,000 people by immersion in one day would be, I would argue, impossible. Not to mention the water would have been horrendously gross by the time 3,000 people. I mean, I would not want to have been the 3,000th person baptized in that water if 2,999 other people had been immersed in the water before I got to it. So it just seems the context of this passage suggests that it was not done by immersion, or at least most of these were not done by immersion. Another example is in Acts chapter 16, and this is the story where St. Paul is miraculously freed from the jail. He and Silas were freed because there was this massive earthquake, and the doors came open and their chains fell off, and St. Paul and Silas were escaping from prison. And the Philippian jailer, he is scared out of his mind, and he says, you know, "Please don't leave," because, and he was about to kill himself. He was going to fall on his sword to kill himself, because he knew, the jailer did, that if they got away, he was going to be killed. He was going to be killed for dereliction of duty, and he knew that. So he was going to kill himself, and they say, "Don't kill yourself. We're here. We're not leaving. Don't worry." So he's like, "Whoa, what's going on here?" So Paul preaches the gospel to him, and he tells him about Jesus. And in verse 31, he says, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." Because the man says in the verse before, "What must I do to be saved?" And they tell him. So then the very next thing we know is he takes them home. Now, this is late at night or early in the morning. So we're talking, this earthquake took place at midnight. They are getting out, and then they stop, and then they converse with this jailer. And so who knows how much time went by? Was it an hour? Was it half an hour? We don't know. But let's say it was an hour. So one in the morning, this jailer takes Paul and Silas to his house. And we're told in verse 33 that this man was baptized and all the members of his family were baptized. I am this close to being 100% certain that they were not baptized by immersion, because first of all, he was poor. He was on one of the very lowest rungs of the social ladder. He didn't have a built-in swimming pool. He didn't have a jacuzzi. He didn't have a bathtub. People didn't bathe the way we bathe now. They would wash their hands and their feet meticulously and their faces, and much of it was ritual washing, but they didn't bathe their bodies anywhere near as often as we do, so they didn't have bodies of standing water. So if you've got this poor guy living in probably a mud hut with his family, and we're told that all of them were baptized at 1 or 2 in the morning, My thinking is, ain't no way that they were baptized by immersion. Again, the verse doesn't say that, but I think the context strongly militates in that direction. So to get back to the issue, whether it's immersion or pouring, both are valid. Now, it seems to me that the lady that you're referring to, Christina, may be unaware of many of these aspects. And so for her, she only knows what she's told. And so maybe in sharing some of these details with her, you might be able to open up the conversation a bit more.
Yes, there you go. Absolutely. Thank you. And it's back to just the whole context of it and the rational thinking or the rationalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And just so you know, too, in the writings of the early church, as early as even the very second century, so just after the apostles had died, when they discuss baptism, they talk about how both forms were practiced. So both immersion and as well as pouring, and both were recognized as valid. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, but I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you. How about now Ralph in New Jersey? Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
I just quickly, I want to make a comment. There was a woman who called earlier from Atlanta, and I feel her pain, but I am aware of the church she's talking about with the high altar and the Latin Mass, because my niece goes there and her husband, and that's the only church that they really feel that they're in church. I was able to get them finally to go back to church.
Mm-hmm.
What we did at our church is we put a kneeler down, and then we brought the paten back, and we have a holy Orthodox priest by the grace of God, and he puts the paten underneath the people as they come up, and not all still kneel. Many still receive in their hands. But at the end of everything, he takes the paten, and he shows the people that he's taking each and every particle. He does it very intricately. So I feel her pain, but I think as long as communion is accepted in the hand, I don't think we'll ever see really true reverence come back. But here's my question now. I'm taking a chance now saying this on Relevant Radio. My nephew is joining the priestly fraternity of St. Peter, and he's wondering, because, you know, Francis was very, very scathing, very disrespectful to those of us who do love the Latin Mass. Is he a schismatic if he were to join the priestly fraternity of St. Peter?
No, I mean, not at all.
You mean, despite the hard, what Francis did say about, he's nervous now. He's so excited about it. This kid was like in love with this. And then Pope Francis came out with that very disturbing letter. But
well,
I know
that with the new motu proprio that severely restricts the traditional Latin Mass, that is going to affect groups like the Fraternity of St. Peter, the FSSP. But your question is, are they schismatic? Absolutely not. They are a bona fide, recognized, canonically, I'm trying to choose all the right words here, there's nothing about them that is in any way schismatic. So they're in the bosom of the church, and these new restrictions, of course, it's going to have to play out to see how these various groups respond, and also if there may be some waivers granted to them, we'll see. But no, to answer your question, they're absolutely not schismatic in any way. I like the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, and I'm happy to hear about your relative's vocation. I hope he has a long and fruitful priestly ministry, God willing. So, and one other thing too, as long as we're at it, just remember that this motu proprio that Pope Francis issued was a direct reversal or even an abrogation of the motu proprio that was issued by Pope Benedict, Summorum Pontificum, which did all the opposite things that this new motu proprio is doing, more or less. So the moral to the story is to remember that Pope Benedict XVI, in his motu proprio, he reversed the circumstances, not necessarily the law, but he reversed the circumstances surrounding the traditional Mass. I think he was certainly right to do so, and I was grateful for Summorum Pontificum. Pope Francis has the authority to do what he did, but a future pope could change that. So do not despair the next pope or the pope after that, he could say, you know what, that was a bad idea. We're not going to do that anymore. And the traditional Latin Mass is going to come back full force and everybody's allowed to celebrate it or go to it. The pope has the right to do that. So just because this motu proprio is in place now doesn't mean it will be in place at some point in the future if a future pope should decide to change it, just as Pope Francis reversed course on what Benedict did. So that's part of the story that has to be kept in mind. You know, we have to play the long game here and consider the fact that the church has been here for 2,000 years. Who knows how much longer we'll be on this planet. But in the meantime, we trust Jesus and we pray for the Pope and we move forward. Thanks, Ralph. God bless you. Hour three is about to start right after this. So please don't go anywhere. And if you want to call me, we have a line that just opened up, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
You're doing great, Pat. Just one more hour left.